Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Devendra Hardwar.
I'm Chris Benor.
And joining us tonight, in place of Dwayne DeFreitas, who is out this week, we have Sean Ludwig, who we had on the show before a couple of times. Sean is also a writer with VentureBeat as well as Devendra. How you doing, Sean?
Doing very good. Yes, I'm not echoey. That's good.
No, you've changed rooms out of the cathedral that you were in before. So.
You know, I was done praying, so time to get to business.
how are things over at VentureBeat, Sean?
Things are going very well. Yes, always crazy, but going very well.
So on this week's episode, we're going to be talking about Google running an end run around some restrictions on Safari in order to get their Plus One to work on iPhones, and also how companies learn your secrets through data mining. But before we get into that, let's talk about some of the headlines. One of the new headlines is Facebook has initiated a verified accounts. They've got verified accounts now. So it's not basically
and pseudonyms and for those people. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow. That's sort of a big deal for Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, I think it's like the dumbest big thing they've done in a long time.
Yeah. It doesn't affect many people, but for the few that it does, it's kind of interesting.
Well, if you are a big celebrity with a weird name, this is perfect. But otherwise, it doesn't affect anyone.
I'm sure, like, their monthly gatherings, you know, they complained about it.
I'm sure, like, Lady Gaga was all like, guys, seriously?
Madonna and Sting and I are really up in arms about this.
Over there in a corner, just like kidding.
It's like, yeah, they have a monthly support meeting with just celebrities with single names or something, like, you know. Yes, it's like a meeting of supervillains.
So basically, what you do is you're able to change your Facebook profile to reflect your nickname or your other name. And there's no way to volunteer to be verified. You have to be chosen. So users who...
It sounds more like an audit
it
now.
It's kind of this weird exclusive club, too. I mean, it's kind of strange.
Like, basically, Facebook is like, let's pick the most popular people that, you know, have the most fans or whatever. Or I guess likes now, not fans. And we will invite them to this special club of verified accounts that have no badges to indicate that they're verified accounts. And we will let the only thing that will indicate they're a verified account will be the fact that they can have a nickname. And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of the benefit is that you get recommended more on Facebook under that account. You can display your real name or your nickname in parentheses on your profile. You have to submit a government issued photo ID to Facebook if you're one of the chosen few. And so it's kind of weird. It's basically the same thing like that Twitter was doing a while back, where there's no rhyme or reason. Like, you're chosen by Twitter to be one of the verified accounts. You can request it all you want, but it's up to them in order to.
Although for Twitter, they did allow people to request it for a little while too. I'm not sure how it works now.
It makes a lot more sense given sort of what Twitter seems to be about. I mean, Twitter is all about fan following and sort of hero worship and all that stuff. And that drives a huge amount of their sort of non-niche traffic. Like, I feel like Twitter has sort of two things that it's doing. On the one hand, it has the sort of niche communities like the startup community and like musical communities and whatnot that sort of all follow each other and allow you to keep track of them. But I think a great deal of Twitter's users use it basically to keep up with Lady Gaga and so whatnot. So like verifying and Twitter doesn't have a great deal of identity built in, you know, aside from that. Like there's no it's not like Facebook where like you have your real friends friending there. You're just sort of following people, so you could be anybody. And so I guess I feel like it kind of makes sense for them to have some sort of verification there. Whereas Facebook is supposed to be about your real identity from the beginning, and is not as much about celebrity worship other than liking things. I don't know. It just seems like a strange move. Not a bad move, just a strange one.
Mm.
Although they do have, you know, they do have that thing where you can subscribe to instead of adding someone as a friend on Facebook, you can subscribe to them, you know, if they're like a big name, a big known name celebrity. And I think that that's probably part of what this will end up being too. This will end up facilitating that whole subscription process with verified names with known celebrities.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on here, Apple unveiled a new version of their Mac OS named Mountain Lion. And the interesting thing about that is that this is going to start – they're starting to fold in features from iOS as regular features on the desktop operating system, which I
– although they're not just – like they're continuing to do that because they've been doing that for a while now and – it's been pretty clear that what OS X has been moving towards is some sort of weird unification, right, of the iOS design, the single screen apps, and all those things.
But it's funny because it's like the whole when iOS first started, there was a lot of it felt kind of like a junior version of their desktop of OS X. And now it feels like the shift is changing so that the flow is going the other way around.
There's an interesting back and forth, right?
Yeah,
because iOS is basically a really, really simplified version of OS X.
Yeah.
So they're kind of – it's interesting the back and forth that's happening there. It's weird comparing it to something like Windows 8, right?
Yeah.
Because Windows 8 is fundamentally different from Windows 7. And Microsoft has to work really hard to push things forward for the tablets, for the future of desktop computing as it is. Apple is just like, whatever, we're gonna start upgrading OS X yearly now, and we don't really care if it's not too different, because it's not really that different. So this is gonna be just like another $30 upgrade, I guess, like Lion was for people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, people talked about how it had a lot of iOS type features. I didn't see anything terribly huge except for the sandboxing, which seems to be sort of Apple's yearly, we're going to see what we can get away with from a developer point of view, see what they make a fuss about, and then change that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's been covered as much in the news, but there's apparently some stipulations about apps needing to be sandboxed and needing to have like certain additional security measures that developers have to implement in order to not have their
developers have to like register now, and I think it's all part of the whole app security thing for the new Mac App Store. You know, it shows like how that is the new paradigm for software development. You don't want to be some random guy on the internet developing software. You want to be a part of Apple's little nice ecosystem.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, on the one hand, a lot of Linux distributions will do that, where there's like, you know, an official repository of the stuff that has been, you know, determined by Canonical or SUSE or Red Hat to have, you know, this is the version that will work, that is, you know, signed by us, that's from our servers. You know, if you want to, you know, have the cutting edge version of something, then you can, you know, add an additional repository, but it's not something we're going to help you do by default. So, but at the same time, Linux is by definition, you know, people who have taken the step of installing this operating system. And so it's a power users type operating system. That's not a terribly high barrier to entry. Whereas, you know, something like a Mac, like for a developer who doesn't want to be in the Apple store or whose application does something that doesn't work well with the sandboxing model that they have, you know, especially if it's like a system app or something, then suddenly, you know, their potential market is drastically reduced, which I'm sure Apple is happy about because, of course, their operating system is perfect and there's nothing you could improve upon it.
Yeah, some of the changes that they're making is that there's like they're very, some of them are very basic where they're keeping features such as iCal or iChat, but they're changing them to match the names that they're given on the iOS platform, like calendar and messaging. They're also going to be incorporating the gaming center, integration with iCloud. With Mountain Lion, users will see same notification screen that scrolls down on the iPhone by swiping their touchpads. I think they're going to be also going to be really sort of incorporating a lot of the touchscreen functionality into Mountain Lion on a broader basis, so that
I think gesture, not necessarily touchscreen,
right? But
touchscreen Macs are, you know, definitely in the future.
Yeah, I was gonna say it feels like they're really kind of laying the groundwork for the desktop version for OS X to really evolve into a touchscreen platform.
Yeah, but again, that's something that they started, you know, years ago too. Like gestures were in there since Leopard. There were, you know, nice gestures on the glass trackpads on the MacBook Pros. It's just the evolution of that. Honestly, at this point, I kind of want to see what the next version of OS X is going to be like—a full new vision. Because it still looks fundamentally the same as it did in 2001.
Yeah, and it's got, you know, it's funny how OS X in some ways has, you know, some absolutely spectacular parts to it, but it has some parts which are really beginning to show their age. I mean, everyone complains about iTunes as this extremely clunky, monstrous application, which now, you know, it's almost part of the operating system as far as, I mean, you can't hardly use the Apple ecosystem without iTunes. And you have to use iTunes for literally everything that you do, you know, relating to media and now relating to your mobile devices and everything else too. I also personally don't like the dock. I think the dock is really clunky. I always have.
Yeah.
It wasn't until Expose that there was actually a great way to manage your Windows in OS X. That's the one thing I always use. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny, well, it's also bizarre that there's no sort of app storage place in OS X. Like, there's the applications folder, but that's where everything goes. There's no, like, it's not like iOS where you sort of have all your apps like right there in one place that's separate from your files. It's just sort of wherever you happen to put them.
They have a launcher now.
Yeah.
Different. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Which I hate.
Actually, the launcher is useless. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like the launcher because you can't really organize it.
You can't organize it. I can't. It's hard to put an app in there when you want it to be there. Just really confusing.
Maybe that'll change with this new version. I don't know. I haven't seen the whole feature set.
I don't know. We'll pay $30 for features that could have easily been a service pack. Like, what gives here?
You will pay $30 for it.
Yeah, no, it really should just be an update. I don't know. It's an update. They're just calling it a new OS.
It's a $30 update, which is, I mean, essentially what Snow Leopard was, right?
Yes.
So I don't know.
I think I'm going to try to start doing this at some point with iOS, where it's like, iOS, you want to get version 5, you have to pay $30 upgrade.
You did charging, like, way back in the iPod Touch days. They charged people, like, $5 to upgrade, remember?
Actually, anymore, I think I know what you're going to say. You have to pay $200, actually, to update. If you want to get the, you know, if you want Siri, you got to update your phone.
That's right.
Yeah, that's your...
That's shocking, by the way, that Siri is not even on this new OS. Where are they going to wait till next year? That just seems kind of weird.
I think so. I get the impression that, you know, I mean, Siri is amazing, but it's also very clear that, it's a sort of project where you need an insane amount of information to make it, you know, really, really, really beautiful. I mean, it definitely has issues parsing some of my stuff occasionally, and it's not always perfect. And I think that, you know, it makes a lot of sense for the mobile in its current state, because anything better is better than having to whip out your phone and start typing in certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I think that they're gonna wait to integrate it until they have a lot more, you know, testing both on the back end and the front end too.
Yeah, yeah. No, maybe the iPhone they still call it a beta. I think using it on the iPhone, I think they're still labeling it as a beta.
Yeah,
so what about you? The iPhone is really our testing ground. And then when we do like a TV with Siri, and we can have Mac Siri, and it'll be great, you know, and Siri can be everywhere that you use Apple.
Kind of like how.
Yes.
Also, one of the things that I found interesting about this announcement is that one of the kind of ubiquitous programs, third-party programs that I use on OS X, which is Growl, which is kind of like an announcement notice that pops up whenever some function that you set makes some sort of change. Apple's going to be incorporating something like Growl automatically into this, effectively putting Growl out of business. So
yeah, they've done that before. You know,
yes.
The Apple way.
The Apple way, yep.
You know, I'm sympathetic to Growl, but at the same time, like, I mean, people talk about how when you build your business or application on somebody else's platform, you're sort of at the mercy of that platform. And I don't know. I feel like there's something to which, you know, if you're maintaining a platform, you have some responsibility to, you know, ensure some autonomy, you know, that people can make things which might not be exactly what you originally wanted. But, like, when you are building some sort of addition to the operating system itself, like – I mean, it's going to happen. Eventually, they're going to improve the operating system or whatnot, and then
yeah.
I mean, it's sort of like when, you know, Microsoft released Security Essentials, and, you know, McAfee and Norton, you know, were quaking in their boots about that. I mean, the entire antivirus industry is built around the fact that Microsoft has for two decades given out a extremely subpar security system in their operating system, and, like, you know, that's great that these businesses came up to take their place, but, like, we can't complain when Microsoft fixes the problem.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like Microsoft, I know people used to make fun of them, right, in the late 90s for stealing ideas and bullying companies, but Apple just kind of, not right, just steals the exact look and functionality of a smaller developer. So it's like, you know, woe be those two who actually, I don't know, dedicate themselves to Apple's platform. Because they may just come in and take everything you've done.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't hurt. Like, Growl is open source. Like, you can just download it, whatever. Like, if they had sold it, Apple may have tried to buy it like they did Siri. They bought Siri. And then they sat on it for a year and worked on it, made it better, and then released it. And so what if, I mean, if Growl had been a, you know, like a paid application, something, I don't know, then maybe Apple would have bought it. Like, they have so much cash. Like, they could have, like, thrown these guys a bone and bought it. I don't know.
Yeah. Or
right. I mean, is that fair? I mean, they could have done that like they did with Siri. I don't know.
Right, yeah, with Siri. Or I mean, I guess it's up to the – basically, I'm sure it's a cost-benefit analysis on their part to, you know, would it be worth it to buy the company or just to copy the functionality?
Just to steal it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
And with Siri, I'm sure there was so much tech involved and so much engineering that they figured it was worth it to purchase the company.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It was also a product, right? Siri was selling a product, whereas, yeah, Sean, you pointed out, you know, Growl is open source, so it's kind of... You can't acquire necessarily.
Yeah, it's kind of their fault. They should, if they would have decided to shift it to be a business. Yeah. I don't know.
They don't seem too worried. No. So that's the thing.
Moving on here. Speaking of Apple, workers at Apple partner Foxconn have alleged that their employer transferred underage employees to other departments or did not schedule them to work overtime in order to avoid discovery during recent inspections by the Fair Labor Association, according to one non-governmental organization. So this does not surprise me at all. I mean, yeah. You know what was really surprising to me was last week when the Fair Labor Association filed their report, and there were like stellar reports coming out of China that the factories were above.
They filed a preliminary report, yeah. Which was basically them like looking around the room, going, "Hey, this looks fine. Let's just announce the news. It's fine. Everything's good."
Yeah. Sort of a weird watch. I mean, you would think that a watchdog organization would sort of understand that that's obviously. I mean, if the company knows that you're coming in, like you're gonna clean up. So like, presumably they would have some sort of way of handling that, right?
Yeah.
I just want to clarify, like when we're saying underage workers here, it's workers between 16 and 18. Mm-hmm, and those like under Apple's provisions, they can work in the factories. They just need, better protections. Like they can't work overtime. They have a certain amount of hours. So I think by just shoving those people away, you know, Foxconn didn't have to answer any of the tough questions about their schedules or anything. Mm-hmm. So it's not like they're hiring 12-year-olds or something. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say that during the Nightline report that was last night, they did ask the Fair Labor Association, like, well, they know you're coming, right? So they're gonna make everything look pretty. And they were like, well, we do bottom up interviews where we can detect and we know the psychology of factory workers, and we pay attention to their mannerisms and all these things. We know that they're going to be hiding some things, but we'll do our best, even though Apple is paying for the audits, which is
and
kind
also
of suspect.
Paid to join that organization too.
Yeah.
So.
Apple's paid $250,000, I think, to join. So Apple wrote them a check for $250,000 and paid for them to fly there and do the audits. So that diminishes some of their credibility.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it still like an independent company, independent verification if it's being done with,
I guess,
on Apple's paycheck?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm sure, but this is, I think this is just, there's still more investigation going on. We may hear other reports, but you know, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think, like I said, the thing that surprised me was the fact that there weren't any sort of red flags the first week that they were out there. That was the big surprising thing.
Yeah.
This feels more like on par with what I would expect from Foxconn. Moving on here. We spoke about this a couple weeks ago, but more details have poured in. Google is, according to several Google employees familiar with the project, Google is going to be making a pair of Google goggles on sale to the public by the end of the year. They're going to cost around the price of current smartphones, somewhere between $250 to $600. They will be Android-based. We were not sure about that last time that we spoke about this. And will include a small screen that'll sit a few inches from someone's eyes. They'll have 3G or 4G data connection and a number of sensors, including motion and GPS. They'll have a low-resolution built-in camera that will be able to monitor the world in real time and overlay information about locations, surrounding buildings, and friends who might be nearby. The glasses are not designed to be worn constantly, although Google expects some of the nerdiest users will wear them a lot. But will be more like smartphones used.
I'm
when
looking
needed.
At you, every Google employee.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, even I have to admit that. I mean, this is like, you know, the Terminator, where you have that Terminator vision and you get to analyze everything in your sight. I mean, who wouldn't want that power?
Spoken like a true geek, Andy. Like, it is the first step to like this sort of like transhumanist ideal, right? Like us literally merging with technology,
right?
I definitely want these, but I don't want the first gen ones because I'm sure they're going to be ugly,
right?
And make you look like a huge dork. So
can I play Dvorak for a moment,
John
here?
Dvorak?
Yes, sure. Feels exactly to me Like, when people talk about, like, Google doesn't get social, this feels to me like Google doesn't get consumer. Like, this feels like exactly the sort of product that a company made up of engineers and geeks would come up with. Like, it's totally out of sci-fi. It's totally, like, what every geek has dreamed of.
Right.
But when you really start to think about it, like, as a product and as a thing, it starts to feel like flying. Like, there's a reason why we don't have flying cars. And it's not just that it's impractical. It's that if you really start to think about it, flying cars are a disaster waiting to happen on so many levels. And that's what I feel like this is, too. Like, what happens the first time somebody's driving one of these and gets in a car accident, or the first time somebody uses them to pull off a crime, or the first time somebody has a seizure because they're in that? Like, you combine that with the fact that they have this huge price tag and are, you know, super, like, dorky looking with, like, minimal external value. Like, I see this thing being, like, a total flop.
Yeah. I mean, it's the huge price tag, right? That is going to keep it
barrier to entry.
A certain type of consumer who is crazy enough to spend $800 on a pair of digital glasses.
Yeah, I feel like this is this year's version of Google Wave, only now it's not free. Like, good idea in theory. I'm sure somebody will eventually do something with it. But I just – this thing has embarrassment written all over it to me. I'm sorry.
Isn't it okay that we have a company that's making a bunch of really geeky sci-fi products? I mean, they've got the money. They can do whatever they want. You know, like, let them build their geeky stuff. And if it flops, it flops. I mean, at least it'll be fun for like a minute. I don't know.
Exactly. Like, let them build.
It'll be on their time.
Let them build and let them fail, because, like, that is essentially, you know – engineers, not only do they think a certain way, they also like to play, and they like to test ideas out. For me, this is more like Google TV, right? Something that has a lot of great potential, but could, especially in its first iteration, was not that great. But then the first Android version was not that great. The first Android phone, same thing. Google's first products, especially the consumer stuff, generally are beta tests, like Gmail was for 5 years. So in a couple versions, though, like, when you can get this sort of tech just built in, like, to a standard frame of glasses, this is the first step to that. Just like Google self-driving cars are the first step to actually having self-driving cars. I'm not sure if that's in the news today, but Nevada just approved the use of self-driving cars, which is that's huge. In the next decade, we're going to have all sorts of crazy, you know, autonomous taxis and whatnot when you go to Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's going to be a little creepy. I'm not sure. It's Johnny Cab from Total Recall, basically.
Exactly. He was helpful.
Right.
I'm looking forward to the self-driving cars, frankly, because I feel like overall we'll end up with less accidents because, I don't know, people are dumb.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
People are dumb. And also, real taxi drivers are terrible. So, yeah.
Right. So it couldn't be worse, right?
The biggest benefit is probably, like, oh, you're drunk. Oh, well, I'm going to turn on the auto drive and I'm going to take me home because it'll be safe, I hope. Yeah. I don't know.
I for one, am looking forward to these glasses. I'm going to – actually, there was a – I contributed to it. There was a Kickstarter campaign a while back.
Oh, come on, Andy. How much did you contribute?
I contributed about $150.
Really?
Yes, to this Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, man.
Do you know the one I'm talking about?
I think I do.
It was called Zionize, and it's it's basically a pair of regular sunglasses that has a built-in camera that has a lot of this kind of functionality. It doesn't have some of the augmented reality stuff that these Google glasses will have, but it will have a lot of this other functionality, like being able to stream directly to your camera phone and save and record off of that. And it was such an interesting concept that I felt that I had to kind of invest.
Just to see. I hope you're not going to lose that money entirely. I hope something happens with that.
Yeah, I hope so too.
But you know what? Like, for me, it's not like the camera is one thing they're talking about. I don't really care about streaming my entire life. That's not as appealing to me as just having, you know, an extra layer of data on top of the physical world. And what can we do with that? I'm seeing some, like, on the mobile side, I'm seeing some really cool stuff happening right now with augmented reality. There's actually a startup now that's going to be launching soon that their whole thing is about just putting augmented reality stuff in physical locations and anybody can come and look at it. And that sort of thing, I think, is just cool. Like, it's cool to play with. But yeah, I want it in actual glasses. I want this stuff fully integrated into my normal, you know, thick-rimmed glasses.
It's a good thing that thick-rimmed glasses are currently in style.
Exactly. Yeah,
thin-rimmed glasses, this would be a disaster.
With rimless, it's impossible, but whatever.
Exactly.
Okay, moving on, and I think this is our last headline here of the night before we get into our main topic. Extensive changes are coming to the Flickr interface, the first of which will roll out next week, according to Marcus Spearing, Flickr's product manager, in an interview with BetaBeat. He demonstrated the completely revamped spread, photos look more than four times their current size and lie neatly justified on the page. Jigsawing together with cropping or changing the order in which they appear. The new photo view will hit on February 28th, and it comes with a new upload interface. So instead of Flickr's kind of awkward app-looking upload page right now, there's going to be more
awkward-looking thing for Flickr. That explains all of Flickr right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, the thing is like with Flickr is a terrific site. Like, mm-hmm. in concept and even in application, but...
It was a terrific site 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And then it stopped being a terrific site, like, 3 years ago when all these other better services came out, so...
Right.
I don't know. It seems like they missed the boat and no amount of redesigning, unless it's like you're going to fundamentally create an app that goes head-to-head with Instagram overnight. I'm not sure what they can do here.
Yeah. Well, especially because we know that on the flip side, yeah, they're doing this on the engineering end. We also mm-hmm. know, like, a couple weeks ago, they laid off, you know, like, a huge percentage of their support staff, including, you know, some of the people who've been there since before it was bought by Yahoo. Like, mm-hmm. so it's like, well, are they killing it off or are they – typical Yahoo, I think they don't even know what they're mm-hmm. doing. They're just like, well, we're going to throw some more engineers, but, you know
– We'll make it prettier, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
BetaBeat, at the very least, came away from their conversation with the Mark Spearing with the impression that Yahoo's not sleeping on Flickr, as some users and former employees have suggested. So who knows? I mean, I'm pulling for Flickr because it's really I don't use Facebook to upload pictures online, as I think most people have kind of shifted away from Flickr to Facebook, or some people never started with Flickr in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I have a ton of photos on Flickr, but, it, you know, I've told this story on the show before. I've been trying for months to pay for a new Flickr Pro subscription, and I just gave up. You know, it's like, I want to give you money. You don't want my money, apparently, so I'm just going to go somewhere else. And I'm hoping that Google's, like, Picasa Photos, or the Google Plus Photos thing, looks great. That actually looks a lot like what Flickr is turning into now. But I think I'd rather try something new at this point than give any more of my life or money to Yahoo.
Did you guys read that Flickr let go of like a lot of their staffers?
Yeah, that's what I was referring to.
Okay, great, you're doing a makeover, but you also just lost like the middle people that are sort of doing all the grunt work. And I think they're just taking money. Yeah, they let go of the people that were going to help the Avenger with his problem, and they just, what is wrong with these guys?
Just a PayPal transaction. Yeah, it's not that hard.
Make anything right.
But the mail's
pretty decent now. At least they've done that. I mean, for God's sake.
I think a lot of that is because they're under the arm of a company who's essentially, you know, struggling to just be around, to be existing.
Yeah.
I mean, Yahoo's, who knows? I mean, I think whoever Yahoo...
I actually contest that characterization. Yahoo has a lot of revenues, and they have the ability, if they wanted to, like, really shake things up, they could, but they don't. I mean, it's like, they know they're in trouble, so why not start shaking things up? I don't know.
I like that. I like that idea. I like that philosophy of, you know, what do we got to lose? But I don't think they ever really knew how to run their business in the first place.
Yeah. Well, they've always thought about themselves as a media company. And honestly, that's where they're the best at. I mean, where Yahoo really shines is like, you know, Yahoo Finance and Yahoo Weather and Yahoo Sports. And
so exciting, you know, yeah.
But hey, they do a better job than, you know, I mean, I'd far rather have Yahoo's coverage on those things than like the Huffington Post or something.
I used to use those things, but a lot of sites came around that are better at those things.
Google Finance is better for finance, yeah. I think, at this point.
You know, Dwayne will continue to contest that they've got the like premier fantasy football site on the internet. So.
They can have that. That's fine.
Actually, I think that's actually right, because I remember I haven't really used it in a while, but I remember you for Final Four and just March Madness and maybe some things here or there. They do have pretty good fantasy sports. We'll give them that.
Yeah.
Good job, Yahoo.
All right. That is it for our headlines this week. But before we get into our main topic, let's talk about a little bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 14-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I want to talk about this week is Dracula by Bram Stoker. And the reason I want to bring this up is that Audible just commissioned a new all-star cast recording of Dracula with Alan Cumming and Tim Curry. And I'm not sure who is playing who. I think Alan Cumming might be playing Dracula this time.
Oh, that would be fun. I want to hear this, yeah.
Yeah. And Tim Curry, I believe, is Dr. Van Helsing in this recording.
I can imagine this already in my head.
Sounds amazing.
Plus, plus they have a full... It's basically a full cast. It's Bram Stoker's original manuscript, which is a series of... set up as a series of letters and journal entries. So it's kind of like a back and forth. It's not like a typical narrative. It's done as a series of journal entries.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought out like the full cast of Audible narrators to
no
to...
Keanu Reeves. Really? Don't we miss him?
Did you... Does anybody miss Keanu Reeves in Dracula?
With the worst possible like accent. Like, I mean, it's like, oh god.
It's weird how beautiful and that movie, the Coppola film.
Yeah,
also has a great score, but then they start talking.
Right. I remember
everybody except Gary Oldman.
That film also had some terrific like practical effects as well.
Yeah, some great visuals. He did some weird sort of like operatic stuff with it. It was a really interesting movie. I actually own it on Blu-ray. It's like a weird failure, but an interesting one at least.
Let me play a little clip here from this version of Dracula. This clip, however, unfortunately has none of the famous name actors that I was referring to. So here's a little clip of Dracula by Bram Stoker.
It is the eve of St. George's Day. Do you not know that tonight, when the clock strikes midnight, all the evil things in the world will have full sway? Do you know where you are going and what you are going to? Oh, she was in such evident distress that I tried to comfort her, but without effect. Finally, she went down on her knees and implored me not to go, at least to wait a day or two before starting. It was all very ridiculous, but I did not feel comfortable. However, there was business to be done, and I could allow nothing to interfere with it.
So that was a little clip from Dracula by Bram Stoker, narrated by a cast of almost a dozen, including Alan Cumming, Tim Curry, and a whole bunch of other Audible regulars. And that book, amongst any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free, plus a free 14-day trial to check out their service. And all you have to do to take advantage of that is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for your free audiobook. Going to that link helps us here on the show, so feel free to do that. And that's it. We're going to take a little break here, play some music, but when we come back, we're going to talk about how big companies like Target and Procter & Gamble are using data mining to figure out exactly who you are and when you're expecting. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Every kiss, every hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me. Let me stay in your arms. I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me. I used to think your love was something that I could take or leave alone. But now I couldn't do without my supply. I need you for my own. Oh, I can't break away. I must have you every day, as regularly as coffee or tea. You've got me in your clutches and I can't get free. You're getting to be a habit with me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down, the Roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Christopher Bernard, and Sean Ludwig. And there was an article this last week and in the New York Times that I just found incredibly fascinating. The article was called How Companies Learn Your Secrets. And it's basically about the science of like predictive data analysis. Let me read a couple pull quotes from this article that were just I thought incredibly fascinating. It focuses on this one guy named Andrew Pohl, who was a statistician for Target for a while, I think before he was ostracized for the company. I think maybe because he said too much about their methodologies. But at the time that he was working for Target, a couple of colleagues from the marketing department asked him that. They said, if we wanted to figure out if a customer is pregnant, even if she didn't want us to know, can you do that? And how that came about is that Target sells everything from milk to stuffed animals, to lawn furniture, to electronics. And one of the company's primary goals is convincing customers that the only store they need is Target. But it's a tough message to get across because once consumers' shopping habits are ingrained, it's incredibly difficult to change them. There are, however, some brief periods in people's lives when their old routines fall apart and their buying habits are suddenly in flux. One of those moments, the moment really, is right around the birth of a child. But timing is everything. The key is to reach them earlier before any other retailers know a baby is on the way, specifically when women are in their second trimester, which is when most expectant mothers begin buying all sorts of new things. Like prenatal vitamins and maternity clothing. So the desire to for decades, Target has collected vast amount of data on every person who walks into one of their stores. Whenever possible, Target assigns each shopper a unique code known internally as the guest ID number that keeps track on everything they buy. If you use a credit card or a coupon, fill out a survey, mail in a refund, call the customer helpline, or open up an email. They'll record it and they link it to your guest ID. Also linked is demographic information like your age, whether you're married, have kids, what part of town you live in, how long it takes to drive you to the store, your estimated salary, a whole bunch of stuff that when Target was contacted, they said there was stuff that they won't even confirm or deny the kind of stuff that they keep track of, but it's a lot of stuff. All that information is meaningless without someone to analyze it and make sense of it. And that's where the analytics department comes in at Target. The reason that Target can snoop on our shopping habits is that over the past two decades, the science of habit formation has become a major field of research in neurology, psychology, as well as an extremely, extremely well-financed corporate labs. Now, what that is all about is that reward loop, what they call a reward loop, and how that works is that inside of our brains, there's a process that creates habits. It's a three-step loop. It's a cue, a trigger that tells your brain to go into automatic mode and what habit to use, and then the routine, which can be physical or mental or emotional, and then finally a reward, which helps your brain figure out if this particular loop is worth remembering for the future. Over time, this loop of cue, routine, reward becomes more and more automatic. What's unique about cues and rewards is how subtle they can be. And this article talks about the one of the examples that they use is the Procter & Gamble, who were starting to market this product of theirs called Febreze. And the marketing was not working because they couldn't get people to even recognize that they needed to deodorize their homes because their noses were used to the smell. But they changed the marketing. They figured out that what they needed to do is create to market Febreze as a reward at the end of this cue routine reward cycle, so that you spray Febreze on in a room after you're done cleaning it. And once they started marketing Febreze that way, their sales shot through the roof. That's one of the examples that they discuss in this article. And another one specifically related to Target was, and what we're talking about is the whole issue with being able to predict when women are pregnant and needing to go needing to shop for stuff for their baby. Target's got they have baby shower registry, but that kind of data was not as useful for them. I mean, they weren't kind of getting that sort of use out of that data as knowing in advance when women are going to be pregnant. So the analysts at Target were able to identify about 25 products which, when analyzed together, allowed them to assign each shopper a pregnancy prediction score. So that they're able to tell exactly within a small window when their due date was coming up. And one of the awkward examples of that was, when they figured out that they were able to pinpoint exactly when that was happening, then all sorts of alarms
alarms went off. That is the alarm of the people understanding how much
they're being... Privacy? Oh, my God.
Yes, that was actually timed. It was a privacy alarm.
That should happen every time you go into a Target now.
Really? So Target, once they figured this out, Target started asking the important questions like, how are women going to react when they figure out exactly how much Target knows? If we send somebody a catalog and say, congratulations on your first child, and they've never told us they're pregnant, that's going to make some people uncomfortable. they said we're very conservative about compliance with all privacy laws, but even if you're following the law, you can do some things where people get really queasy.
That's a good quote right there.
And the article says that about a year after this statistician, Andrew Pohl, created the pregnancy prediction model, a man walked into Target outside Minneapolis and demanded to see the manager. He was clutching coupons that had been sent to his daughter, and he was angry, according to an employee who had participated in the conversation. My daughter got this in the mail, he said. She's still in high school, and you're sending her coupons for baby clothes and cribs? Are you trying to encourage her to get pregnant? The manager didn't have any idea what the man was talking about. He looked at the mailer. Sure enough, it was addressed to the man's daughter and contained advertisements for maternity clothing, nursery furniture, and pictures of smiling infants. The manager apologized and then called a few days later to apologize again. On the phone, though, the father was somewhat abashed. I had a talk with my daughter, he said. It turns out there has been some activities in my house I haven't been completely aware of. She's due in August. I owe you guys an apology. So the question became, how did they get their advertisements into expectant mothers' hands without making it appear that they were spying on them? How do you take advantage of someone's habits without letting them know you're studying their lives? And one of the ways that they did this was they found out that as long as a pregnant woman doesn't think she hasn't been spied on, she'll use their coupons. So what they did was they started mixing in ads for things they knew pregnant women would never buy. So that the ads that they did include, the baby ads, looked random. They put an ad for a lawnmower next to diapers. They put a coupon for wine glasses next to infant clothes. That way it looked like all the products had been chosen by chance.
Unless it was a really bad mother. Unless it was a really bad mother. Wine glasses with your diapers? Hey, go for it.
Sure.
So women, you know, pregnant women, expecting women who taking a look at those flyers just assume that everyone on their block got the same mailer for diapers and cribs. Mm-hmm. So it's like a delicate balance in there about how creepy for lack of a better word, to get with people when you're mining this data. But what I thought was really fascinating, the overall takeaway from this article was just how accurate the science of data mining and analysis allowed you to get into someone's life.
Yeah.
And
statistics is more powerful than most people think, you know, especially when it's used correctly. But actually, this report got me thinking, like, I've gotten coupon mailings from Target in the past, mm-hmm. and sometimes there have been those really just like useful coupons, and now I'm wondering, wait, did they know something? Did they know I wanted this? it's one of those things that kind of makes you rethink your whole history with this company.
I mean, they're in a place, when you really think about it, they're in a place to do they're a unique place to do this. They offer almost everything. I mean, you're giving them your credit card, unless you're paying in cash every time. Like, you're giving them your identity every time you go there anywhere in the country. And so, you know, they can track, you know, who you are, what your name is, roughly where you live. And then based on your purchasing habits, probably not that hard to figure out, like, you know, a lot of the rest of this information, you know, based on, you know, good statistics.
And this is happening Target, like everywhere that has like a company card to like CVS or any pharmacy. So if you have a card, you should know you're definitely being tracked at that point. The weird thing is that Target is doing this without even having any of that. But go ahead, Sean.
I've been shopping at Target probably almost exclusively for about 3 years. So they probably have a ton of information about me that I do not know. I feel like it was 15 years ago where suddenly everyone was introducing loyalty cards.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I remember being like a kid and we saw this. Every store started introducing, like, you need this card to get these deals. We have these deals, but they're only for people with our card. And I was like, around that time, I remembered, like, well, wait a minute. What's the incentive? Like, why? And the idea is they want to collect the data so they know better how to serve you, because
full profile. Right? Like, the whole point is you have this one thing. You don't need to clip coupons every Sunday, and you still get the savings.
Except you could actually, you know, sometimes you combine that. You could actually clip coupons and use a loyalty or whatever and get extra deals. But basically the point was I remember the first time this ever happened where I needed to get was like 16, I needed to get this loyalty card, and I signed all this information to them, and I was like, that feels weird. Like, I'm giving them a lot of data just so I can get an occasional deal. But I remember that the first time I ever signed up for a loyalty card, and I was like, yeah, this is definitely a little weird, but you know, you still do it because you want the deal.
The key is to give them as little personal data as you can. Like, most of the time, if you go to a store and just ask them, can I have a new card? I lost my old one. They give you a form to fill out or something, but you can usually just take the card and walk away. And you have this one thing, and it'll track it, but you can, you know, throw it away and get a new one.
Davinder, you say that's the aim, but, like, to what end? I mean, what's the aim of doing that? So that they don't give you deals for things that you want?
Well, no, the aim is for people who are really worried about being tracked. You have this, you know, little device that still gets you the deals, but, you know, you throw it out every month or something. But, you know, you still get the deals. You just lose the whatever extra bonuses they get. And Chris, why are you laughing? You were the guy who gave up Facebook. This is people like you I'm talking about, Chris.
Facebook, yeah. It's much more an issue of control. I don't know. I have mixed feelings. I'm not a privacy.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, and it seems like Facebook is a prime example. Like, they track you all over the place, and you'll see targeted advertising on there that is eerily accurate, you know, in a very creepy way on right. Facebook.
Well, Google started that, but Facebook sort of perfected it with your friends.
Mm-hmm.
It goes even a step further.
Facebook is bizarre.
The thing about Facebook is, like, not only do they do the targeted ad, but they'll tell you that your friend likes it to try to encourage you to click it, you know? And
Facebook gets creepy to me, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but that's the point of Facebook. It's data mining. It's really – and you're giving all of your data freely to them, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear the so stepping away from this news a bit, Andy, did you hear the controversy surrounding this report? Not much of a controversy. It was just the media thing. Apparently, Forbes, Kashmir Hill at Forbes, reblogged this New York Times piece.
Uh-huh.
And she gave it a much, much better title. So the New York Times title is kind of boring and dry. It's How Companies Learn Your Secrets. And that could mean anything, right? That could apply to cookies. That could apply to, you know, online tracking.
Sure.
So the Forbes title is How Target Figured It Out A Teen Girl Was Pregnant Before Her Father Did. Which is just like instantly compelling. Just like, right. I want to read the story right now. So I think it was the New York Times editor just wrote a post. So his title was like Forbes, How Forbes Stole Our Story or something.
Everybody wants to
talk. Which I don't think that it was a commentator.
Literally stole the story, but he was being, you know, he was having a really powerful title too. That was like what he was doing. But the real key is the Forbes story was shared a lot more. And it seemed to be.
With an enticing title like that.
The Forbes one currently has 1.2 million page views.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's pretty nice for being a week, I think.
Yeah.
No,
I'll
admit it was the Forbes story that first pulled me into that first engaged me with this story, and then I dove into when I found out that it was, you know, reblogging something from New York Times. I decided to read that one in depth and get the full story.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But yeah, the controversy just was that look at here Forbes. They just kind of copied and pasted the story. They did copy and paste huge chunks of it, but they also sourced it. And they did much better traffic-wise. It's just one of those things that goes to show, like, the difference between, you know, the way a traditional media company thinks.
Yeah.
Like, on the New York Times, where, you know, on the print paper, where the headlines just kind of have to convey a thing, they're not fighting against other, you know, properties within the same page. They're just, it's a headline. And it can be nice and classy and whatever. But on the web, you're fighting against everything, right? You're fighting against people's Twitter feeds, their Facebook friends, IM chats, all the other sites online. So you need a killer title. This was just a really interesting example. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And this is actually the New York Times Magazine. So actually, this is probably was in magazine form, and you actually.
Yeah, and in fact,
this was a book. Yeah.
In fact, the article in the New York Times is called How Companies Learn Your Secrets, or How Companies Learn Your Secrets. But the cover of the New York Times Magazine itself that linked to the article was called Hey, You're Having a Baby. And it was like a photo collage of all of these products from Target that
See, that's also not Forbes definitely executed better. It's like, oh, I'm having a baby. Well, clearly it's the baby issue. I'm not having a baby. Yeah. I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
It's a sense. I mean, that's happened a number of times where, like, the canonical version of a particular, like, story or meme or whatever is not the original one. It's the best executed one or the best, you know, most popular one or whatever. I don't know. I find it more interesting than anything else. I mean, I can't really fault Forbes at all. They did what everyone, you know, is doing these days. And it's not like other, you know, it's not like you don't read things in the New York Times and be like, according to an exclusive by, you know, the Wall Street Journal this week, you know, an investigation is. I mean, newspapers have been quote unquote reblogging each other for far longer than there have been blogs. They just, you know, they do the exact same thing. They just say, according to a, you know, report obtained by the New York Times, such and such and such and such has happened. Like,
well, the way newspapers do is a little different, right? Because they usually try to add their own reporting on top of it, right? So they report what somebody else did, and then they add their own analyst or something. That happened when one of our writers had that great post about Jen had that great post about how all the mobile apps are stealing your data in a way. And then Nick Bilton at the Bits blog in New York Times reblogged it and added some more quotes and talked to other people. That's how they generally do things. But on the web, right, I guess people can just like, we are used to, in a sense, just saying, hey, summarizing story, maybe giving a few choice quotes and saying, giving a bit of analysis and why this is cool and interesting. That's the new reblog without, I guess, much other additional insight or anything tapped onto it. So some people took issue with that. I had an argument with one of the film critics, one of the New York film critics who just loves to complain about everything. David Poland? I think it was David Poland. And he was arguing on Twitter, and I was like, they didn't do anything wrong. I'm very sorry, but this isn't the end of the world.
Well, and I think in that case, it's basically like you're making up the rules as you go as you go along. So
exactly,
if you decide that that's okay, that that's kosher, then eventually it becomes kosher with enough people doing it. Yeah. It's like the English language; it's malleable, you know.
But also, like I think, like the internet allows for a better flow of information, right, than previous than newspapers did. Now anybody has a platform and they can just, you know, share ideas. It's all about sharing ideas is what reblogging is, unless you're just literally copying and pasting a story and trying to claim it's your own. That is terrible.
Yeah. It's curation. I mean, it gets back to what we were talking about last week. I think that that's becoming increasingly one of the most important values that a lot of news outlets give. I mean, the information is there for anyone to see, but having a source that matches your you know, tastes and interests and everything, and that you trust to have, you know, good additional commentary or whatever on it is sort of the primary thing that you know, one has. We complain about the echo chamber because, I mean, everyone has to cover every topic if everyone else is covering it. So why do you go to, you know, VentureBeat over TechCrunch or whatever? It's like, well, I hate TechCrunch. and VentureBeat has, like, really, you know, much better, you know, writing and much better curation of what is there and what's sort of junk. So I don't know.
Just kind of closing off this the topic of the data analysis, does anybody get that kind of creepy sense of feeling that they're being intruded on when the data is being collected by our habits and not necessarily by specific specific personal information that we're giving these companies?
Right. It's not like a card. It's just how you behave when you can walk into a store.
Right. I mean, we can't. The unfortunate thing about that is that we can't avoid that. We can't change our habits. It's like changing our fingerprints. We can't. It's who we are. We can lie about our name. We can give a false address. We can, you know, not divulge our telephone numbers, but we can't change our habits.
I think I ranted about this before, but I've kind of lost the sense that I think there really isn't any more privacy anymore. Like, because of what we do and how we, you know, how we deal with things in the world and the complexity of the technology that we have now to study our habits, to track us, to do all these things, we've really lost that privacy. And we have to, I think, accept, you know, we use our credit cards, we're going to be tracked. And when we use Google, we're going to be tracked. When we use Facebook, we're going to be tracked. It's just how we live now. Yeah. And we have to either, I don't know, you can do like what Devenger does and, you know, they give you a card and you run off with it without signing your address.
Well, I don't throw them out. I also don't throw them out. You know, I actually use the information. It's just, you know, if you don't have to give up your information, if you literally don't have to sit down and write a form and you can just take this thing, why not?
You know, so you know what this is something I do online is when you have to put in like your birth date, I don't put the right date in. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like certain little things like that, you know, don't tell anyone.
Well, easier. It's just easier to flip the years down until you get past 18. Right. And then,
I know. But I'm saying it's like, if I can get around it, I will, but I'm pretty sure I'm screwed. So
You know, I guess for me, it's like, I don't know. You guys know I have a weird, I mean, I quit Facebook at one point and came back and whatever. And I used DuckDuckGo and everything. But at the same time, I've been on the other side too. And I know, I mean, like when DaVinci and I were doing tech support and, you know, the same problem I've had at you know, all the startups I've worked at, like, you know, you're trying to provide a service for people. In some cases, it's free, like with tech support. In some cases, it's a product, like at a startup. In some cases, it's a, you know, something that's free, but it's still like how you serve your product, whatever. And like, on the one hand, like, yes, you're definitely trying to, you know, get people to pay you. On the other hand, like, I don't know, I generally want to solve people's problems with my product, and I need to know what they're doing on it. I need to know how they're using it in order to figure that out. And I can't pull them all in, and I can't have them all come in and, you know, tell me all their problems. I have to look at the error reports and the tracking cookies and figure out, like, oh, funny, no one's going to this particular site that I spent like 2 weeks programming. Like, maybe it's because like the link is hidden in the wrong part of the page or something. Yeah. Like, you know, on the one hand, like, there is, you know, this sort of creepy tracking and whatever. On the other hand, like, I guess the cutoff for me is like, are they using it to improve or detract from my experience?
Yeah, if it's mutually beneficial, it's less of a problem. And especially if, like, you know, your shopping experience is better with this stuff. I loved Target generally because they have stuff I like and they have it cheaper than many other stores. It's a store that I've just grown to love since living in Amherst for many, many years. It was probably one of the best places to go there. So, yeah, we can also use data to our own advantage now with stuff like the Jawbone up and other things that can help you self-improve. So really, like, we have all this data swimming around us. It's really the choice of, you know, what are we doing with it?
Any geek who's interested in data and its sort of effects on society should read, if they haven't already, Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
Oh, yeah.
Which I think is the sort of original and classic. And if you have read it before, I'd recommend rereading it. I mean, it certainly doesn't talk as much about privacy as, and he doesn't even envision the sort of granularity that we're able to, you know, he has this vision that you're going to be able to see things on the grand level, but not on the individual level. And the amazing thing about what we have now is that we can actually see things on the individual level.
Yeah.
But
Foundation is actually a really interesting read right now because, one of the first scenes, right, is, the guy landing on the new planet and, you know, he's seeing the huge city for the first time. Everyone is looking down at devices in their hands as they're walking around without looking up, and they're following the signals, you know, the directional arrows that these devices are kind of showing them. It's like, oh my God,
this is
every single sidewalk now, you know, with your smartphone.
Wow.
Especially downtown Mountain View. Especially downtown Mountain View. I have to be very careful driving in Mountain View.
All right. Okay. So we're going to take another little break here and take a little listen to a little bit of music. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how Google is sidestepping restrictions on Safari to and actually on Internet Explorer as well to get their message to you and what that means for them. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Chases me. You know my name. You know my face. You'd know my heart if you knew my place. I walk straight down as far as I can go.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Devinder Hardawar, Christopher Bernor, and Sean Ludwig. And our final word tonight, let's talk about this issue with Google. Google and other advertising companies apparently have been bypassing the privacy settings of millions of people using Apple's web browser on their iPhones and computers, tracking the web browsing habits of people who intended for that kind of monitoring to be blocked via Safari. Google has been using a, according to I can't even remember what article where I pulled this article from. I think it was
Wall Street Journal.
According to the Wall Street Journal, Google has been using a special computer code that tricks Apple Safari's web browsing software into letting them monitor many users. Safari is designed to block such tracking by default. Now, I'll be the first to admit that how they do this is maybe a little technically out of my bounds, and I'm hoping maybe one of you can explain exactly what Google has done here.
Oh no.
The thing is, so this news was actually brought up years ago. This isn't actually new information, so it's surprising that this is being dug up again and, being thrown at Google. I guess the real interesting thing is to see, look at how, so basically what they were doing is just like, they weren't tracking personal information, but they were using cookies in a way so that if you signed into Google Plus and, you moved around the web, when you came back to a Google Plus page or something with the Google Plus button, you could just hit that, without signing into Google Plus again. And it's something a lot of other services are using. So it's not like they're willfully going around this, and it's not like Apple doesn't know this is happening. But I guess just like Path, right? Just like that is a technique that a lot of people were using, which I think that's actually an invasive technique because that actually gives people personal information. A lot of people were using it, and now there's this big uproar, and Microsoft is trying to be all holier than thou.
Hasn't Facebook integration with a lot of sites also sort of like they sort of know you've been on certain things? I mean, that they've integrated Facebook liking on all these different sites, and I don't know. Like they know.
The question is on the mobile side, because and actually, I guess desktop Safari is supposed to be blocking this too. But the real issue here is that Safari and mobile is letting this stuff go through. Like they nefariously worked around a way to put cookies on your iPhone. That's not necessarily what happened, I guess.
Seems like it's more of a Safari. I mean, if you're offering a browser that has this feature, which is not a, it's not a standard. I mean, to my knowledge, I don't think there's an official draft, or I mean, there might be a draft, but there's not an official spec of okay, this is how people are going to opt out of tracking, and this is how things are going to implement it. It seems to me that if you're a browser manufacturer and you're offering this feature, you should make sure that it works. Don't blame people who are, not checking up on what you're, I don't know. I mean, I just think as a developer, I write stuff and I have it write a cookie when I need it to do things. Mm-hmm. And, I hope that the cookie writes there so that it'll do the thing that I wanted it to do. And I mean, I'm not checking to see what every single browser is doing in terms of their privacy policy and checking the privacy API to see whether or not they have them, because it's not like JavaScript has that just sort of built in. It's like a jQuery extension I can use. I mean, but I don't think that's what Google's doing here. It sounds like they're actually getting around in a sort of more nefarious way.
So you know what it sounds like? It sounds like it's a battle between developers in a way. Google has this purpose. They're like, we want to track people better, and we want to make sure we're serving good ads. Yeah. And Apple has Safari. They've built it in such a way that they don't want, certain companies to do this. But some, companies get around it. They figure out the holes, and they work their magic. And so, if Apple is really upset about this, or Microsoft is upset about IE having these holes, well, fill the holes, guys. I mean, just, get off your bums and fix it. I don't know.
Has anyone checked to see whether or not Microsoft is using the same things, or Bing or something? That would be the ultimate.
That'd be hilarious.
I almost want that to be true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're putting this under the guise of privacy settings. And I guess after all the path hubbub, right? It's supposed to make Google look really bad because, oh my God, look at what Google's doing. But the real key is what Path was doing and what a lot of those other apps were doing was literally pushing your contacts to other people, and that is personal information. Versus, at least the type of cookies I think Google has been dropping has just been collecting activity, not necessarily personal data. So that's the big difference I'd make here if people are wondering, like, why we're being easy on Google and hard on Path or something.
It also just feels, it feels like just sort of, I mean, even if Google, I don't know, it feels manufactured from Microsoft and like they just want to like, and it's, I mean, it's telling that like, on the one hand, like Google is accused of doing this thing. On the other hand, like the patch that fixed, at least not this flaw, but the previous flaw that was the controversy like last week, the patch that fixed that was submitted by Google engineers. Like, I think it's hard to make the case that like Google as an organization is nefariously doing these things. Google is a big organization, and like it has different departments have different aims and different things that they're supposed to be doing. I don't say that to defend them. I don't just know enough about the situation to even like figure out like what it is they did wrong, or I don't know. I mean, it's also part of the difficulties. Like, browsers are going in opposite directions in terms of this stuff. Like, right? So like it used to be you could only store data on the computer via a cookie. One of the sort of big HTML5 specs is something called local storage, which is a key value pair. It might even be based on SQLite, but I think it's just a key value pair where you can store like up to 5 megabytes of information per page in this database that's part of the browser. And that's like part of the HTML5 spec.
And you can actually, specific pages can request for more storage too. I've seen this happen. They can request up to 50 megs or something.
Yeah, so you can store like a great deal of information about somebody on a page, and yet at the same time, browsers are trying to like make these like, oh, you can't store anything about us. I mean, what's to stop Google from storing stuff in local storage? I don't know. It just, I think there's a lot of, like you said, it's a battle between developers. Like, there's a whole bunch of different technologies that are coming out, and like different purposes for what they'll be doing at, and most importantly, there's not an established set of social norms for what is appropriate. And so, you know, things that people have been doing for years, people, so it sort of comes out that people are doing it, and suddenly everyone's like, oh my gosh, like, I didn't know they were doing that. And then, of course, the developers are like, what? We've been doing that for a while.
Right. Well, it's, as long as you're not breaking the law, you can do whatever you want. I mean, you know, you're going to build the best technology for your purpose, and you have a, somebody like Google has an explicit purpose to track you and to serve you ads. I mean, why, let them do what they want to do. If, you know, you want to be, you know, stand up to them. And, you know, honestly, whoever said this was manufactured, I think might have hit the nail on the head. This does feel very manufactured. Microsoft has been taking like aim at Google lately, just trying to hit them hard over the head.
Yeah,
trying to establish themselves like, well, Google is evil.
It's all these patent battles too. Yeah,
and so I feel like this is a manufactured controversy. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, it's not said there might not be something here, but it's impossible to tell when the accuser is just another giant company that's tracking stuff via your operating system habits. I mean, like, you're worried about a Google dragging your surfing habits. How about, like, even if you're not plugged in? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think.
Hey, well, if you have an Android phone, they are tracking you everywhere you go all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
They're building a TV service, guys. Another piece of news that just hit today, you know, in Kansas City.
Kansas City, holla.
Yeah. Wait, in Kansas City, Google is, like, signed the forms to basically broadcast TV. In preparation for like a paid TV service, so this could happen, like a Google competitor to Comcast or something.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's getting more and more interesting.
Google Stream Picks that you can only see if you're wearing their glasses.
That's something I would totally.
It'll be like that Doctor Who where everyone has the cell phone like plugins to your ears, and then the Daleks use that. Or no, it's the Cybermen. Use that to take over the entire population of London and turn them into Cybermen. That's what Google's real aim is.
Is anyone a little, actually, thinking about all the different services, is anyone kind of scared of what Google can do? Like, do you, anybody use Chrome, Gmail, what else? I guess you could do
search.
Google Search, Chromebook, Google Plus, YouTube. You imagine to have the Google Pay TV service. You know what I mean? Like, all of those things in your life would be all Google all the time. Android phone, another key implement. Like, imagine if you had all of those things, how much does that mean Google knows about you if you have all of those things? Everything.
Yeah. I mean, Google does. Yes, absolutely. I think maybe, you know, Google's the range of Google's knowledge on you is probably more extensive than Target's in the example that we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely.
And especially, you know, with this one, you know, how they recently consolidated all their permissions to one set of user agreements.
Yeah, one privacy policy that covers all services. Yes.
Right. So, I mean, essentially, they know so much about us. I don't even want to know because I have a feeling if people understood exactly how much Google knew about us based on our habits, that that there would be a huge uproar that would eclipse, you know, what we've seen here with Path or with this Safari issue.
Did anyone see the advertising campaign that Google did for the privacy, for the new privacy settings?
Mm-hmm.
Devendra, did you see Subway advertising for that?
Yeah, there's Subway advertising that's like, it's weird. It's just like saying you wouldn't leave your doors open. It's like you wouldn't leave your doors open for a thief to go in.
Yeah,
I'm not worried about thieves. I'm worried about peeping toms.
So are they wanting you to log out of your? What are they asking you to do?
No. The campaign is to make you feel more comfortable with their privacy, which to me I felt like was drawing like red flags out.
Yeah,
actually,
right. It was about the unified privacy agreement, right? So that was what people were complaining about, and those ads were supposed to be like, well, if you sign out of YouTube, you know, you get signed out of everything, or kind of like privacy is all together now; it's all in one spot. But I don't know if that message was really came across.
I felt like I was more worried, like when I see those ads and they're trying to comfort me, I was like, you're just making me more concerned about this. Yeah, I don't know. I'm one of those people. I don't believe in real privacy anymore. But Google probably worries me more than any of them. So
privacy is an illusion, men. There's nothing we can do anymore.
Yes,
I think
exactly.
that's probably the takeaway from this entire episode. all right. Any other last things that we want to bring up before we close off the show here tonight?
Well, I hope to come back with some interesting mobile tech stories from mobile.
I'm actually looking forward to what you got to say from your journey.
Well, apparently LG just announced their quad-core Android phone. So this looks like the beginning of the deluge of quad-core phones.
Oh, no. It's great. Just what we need.
Exactly. It's like just what we need while my little iPhone 4S is still fine over here. Oh, well.
I mean, maybe we'll see some legit, phones that you can sort of plug into an outlet and they can be your computer. I mean, like legitimately. So, yeah.
So like a Raspberry Pi, except like twice as expensive?
Yes. Exactly.
All right. Devendra, where can we find you on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
And you can find me slaving away at VentureBeat.com, along with Sean, and on Twitter at Twitter.com/Devendra. I podcast about movies and TV and fun stuff at SlashFilm.com. Everything else I do is at Devendra.org.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find you online when you're not here on the show?
Well, I spend most of my days lounging around the pool at the startup pad, unlike Devendra. So you can find me on Twitter at Chris Bernor, CHRISBURNOR. And I'm co-curating the Startup Digest reading list every week. I'm putting the technical articles and what we think are the best articles on the internet for people who are trying to get started in the startup world. And then everything else I do is at chrisbernor.com and blog.chrisbernor.com.
And Sean, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not helping us out here on the show?
Along with Devendra, you can find me at VentureBeat.com writing absurd headlines. And you can also find me at Twitter.com/SeanLudwig, SeanLudwig. And also sort of everything that I do on the web can be found at SeanLudwig.com.
All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or Gplus.to, MrBabyMan. That's my Google Plus profile where all of my social links are stored. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down on geeksofdoom.com and also thedrilldown.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Just go to geeksofdoom.com and our subscription link is there on the right-hand sidebar. Facebook.com/thedrilldown, Twitter.com/thedrilldown. Please sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. We've been restarting that. We used to do that a while back, and we stopped doing it, and we're starting it up again because it works pretty well. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on thedrilldown.com. And you can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location when our guests will be some of Reddit.com's top users. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.